Listeners, welcome to U-Rising. I'm Chris Nelson, host of this episode and Chief University Relations Officer. Today, I'm talking with Aaron Fox about recent and ongoing prescription drug shortages, from antibiotics to chemotherapy and ADHD drugs. Aaron is an adjunct professor of pharmacy and the associate chief pharmacy officer at University of Utah Health. She is the go-to expert for national media on this problem, and I'm excited to have Aaron share her insights with us. Welcome to U-Rising, Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get right into it. Currently, how many active drug shortages are you and your team monitoring right now?
We are watching about just over 300 active and ongoing drug shortages. Some of those began even in 2012, but some of them began more recently.
Is this a new phenomenon, or how long do drug shortages go back? Have they always existed? Are we just getting better at tracking them? What has changed, if anything?
We've been tracking drug shortages here at University of Utah since 2001 nationally. Before that, we had a really good system of tracking locally, but that national tracking didn't really get started until 2001. FDA began a little bit earlier. They had a Y2K plan to monitor some drug shortages, and those team members from that Y2K plan formed FDA's drug shortage team.
What are some of the prescription drugs currently in short supply that listeners might be familiar with?
You know, people might have heard of some chemotherapy shortages, basic chemotherapy like cisplatin or carboplatin. People might also think about lidocaine injection. So this is something that if you go to the doctor's office because you need to get some stitches, if you have a quick mole removed, lidocaine is really used everywhere.
And even saline has been in short supply at different points of time.
It has. And that sounds ridiculous, right? How can something that is just salt and water be short? But we've definitely had shortages of saline.
What's the criteria for declaring a shortage of any specific prescription drug? Is there a uniform shortage criteria, or does it vary based on the drug?
Yeah, that can get confusing because there are a couple different definitions. So the FDA uses a different definition than my team and I use for our national work. But, you know, we have really more of a patient-focused definition where if a drug isn't available and the pharmacy has to change the way that it's prepared or dispensed, or a provider has to use an alternative, or a patient just has to go without therapy, that's our definition of a shortage. And we verify those shortages directly with manufacturers. So we're not talking about a really quick back order of 2 or 3 days. These are usually pretty long-term shortages.
So this is a loaded question, but I'll ask it. What are the root causes of these drug shortages? And I know there's probably not a singular one, but how would you explain that to a lay audience?
In most cases, we don't actually get to know the true reason for a shortage. Drug companies are not required to publicly disclose that information. They do disclose it to the FDA, and that has been law since 2011. So what we have are some aggregate data from FDA, and they tell us that in more than two-thirds of the cases of any shortage, it's a quality problem at the manufacturing facility.
Interesting. What are the roles of hospitals and pharmacies and supply chain? So is the root cause, you know, at the manufacturing level, is there ever a shortage based on just supply chain or certain hospitals keeping too much of something, or is that?
Sure. You know, hoarding comes into play. You know, everyone wants a tool to help them predict shortages. Why do they want that? So they can find out earlier and buy more. In some cases, we see an increased demand. We saw that at the start of COVID when hospitals were starting to stockpile medications, expecting a huge influx of patients. Sometimes hospitals just, you know, forget to order something, but that's pretty rare to have a long-term shortage just because someone forgets to push a button. It's usually some kind of more systemic problem within the entire supply chain.
So you deal with this every day, but for somebody who, you know, occasionally goes to the doctor, they get a prescription, they just expect to go to the pharmacy. Can you take us behind the scenes, the role of the FDA and the role of the manufacturers? You know, FDA obviously approves, regulates the drugs, and the manufacturers produce it. But what is happening behind the scenes that people who are just, you know, going to the pharmacy to pick up that medication just may not see or even know?
There's a lot of steps. So the FDA does regulate the drug companies and what they're allowed to manufacture. But from there, the FDA really doesn't have a lot of power over the drug companies. They can't force any company to make any critical drug, no matter how life-saving it is. So really, the drug companies, we have a very free market system in the U.S. So the drug companies are manufacturing drugs. They're usually choosing the ones that are the most profitable for them to make or ones that they have good experience in making. Those drugs are made. Then they're usually shipped to a wholesaler where a hospital buys small amounts, maybe every couple of days, maybe once a week. If it's a really small clinic, maybe only once a month. But, that overall supply chain can get really fragile when a manufacturer has a glitch. A lot of times the manufacturer only makes just enough. And they're only making it just in time. So that means a manufacturer on any given day doesn't have, say, a six-month safety stock to, make up the difference in case there's a glitch. They might have 1 month. But if they have a manufacturing problem that takes them 8 months to solve, that's where we see those gaps. And these are very inexpensive, low-cost drugs. The drug companies aren't making any money on these drugs. Right. And so they don't have that incentive to really make any extra. They almost have an incentive to make just enough. And if there's a shortage, they don't lose any money. But patients pay the price. And that's what's so frustrating about this issue.
So it's interesting. So the generic ones have the higher prevalence of the shortages. Whereas, is it a patent on a drug? Is that what you?
Yeah.
So the companies who still have their patent are probably making plenty of that because they're still making a lot of revenue.
Right. So drugs that are still branded, brand name, under patent, those companies have a lot of incentives to have a backup plan and to have that safety stock, maybe even have a couple locations where they make a product and to really invest in their manufacturing lines. A generic supplier, often they're making 30 or 40 different drugs on a single manufacturing line. If anything happens to that manufacturing line, it affects a large number of products. They're really not making a lot of profit on those drugs. So the drugs that we generally see in short supply are hard to make, things that are injectable, that you have to keep sterile and particle-free, and that have been generic and around for a long time.
So Aaron, where are most prescription drugs made? Are they made overseas? Are they made in the United States? How does a drug become a drug? What's that manufacturing process look like?
Manufacturing is very global. And so there certainly are drugs that are made overseas. But a lot of the drugs that are in short supply right now are actually made in U.S. factories. It's kind of a misconception that all of these shortages are due to drugs being made overseas. And if we had more factories in the U.S., it would resolve everything. Certainly, you could think of a geopolitical argument for onshoring more drug production, but would it help solve shortages? It would not.
And like you were saying, the drugs are manufactured, but all the raw materials are coming from different places.
They are. Raw materials do come mostly from India and China. We don't always know the exact amount. And again, that's another thing that drug companies are allowed to keep as a trade secret, where their raw material comes from and which company is making it.
All right. So we give you all the power in the world. How do you solve this problem? How do you prevent these shortages?
I would love to have a magic wand and give purchasers of drugs something else to rate a medication on besides just a pass-fail system that it's on the market or not on the market. What has happened with generic drugs is that FDA says that they're all equal. And so that's great. But unfortunately, the FDA sees that there really are differences behind the scenes. When all drugs are equal, the only thing you have to compete on is price. And you get a race to the bottom on prices. And that's where you get people dropping out or taking shortcuts on their quality. And so I would like to see a rating system, maybe a letter grade system, where perhaps payers only pay for, let's say, B+ grade and above. That would really incentivize the manufacturers to invest in their supply chains and purchasers. I'm in charge of our $600 million drug budget. I would like us to spend that money on the highest quality products.
Sounds good. I'll have to find that magic wand for you.
I would love that.
Take me into the life of a hospital pharmacist. Again, until I worked in healthcare and saw the amazing inpatient pharmacists, and this is not a knock in any way at local pharmacists, but I show up, the medicine's always there, but you're in a hospital, you're in a critical moment, and that drug is short. What does that look like for those hospital-based pharmacists? What amazing efforts are they doing behind the scenes that people probably just have zero idea or appreciation for?
One example that I like to talk about is what happens when crash cart medications are short. So this is on TV, people are calling a code blue or, crash. And you have a tray with a very set number of medications and they're in a set formulation. A lot of those have been short. We can usually get a substitute, but instead of it being a pre-filled syringe, it's a vial or maybe three vials. And in that emergency situation, you're so used to just grabbing that prefilled vial and being able to hand it over to be administered to the patient. When you have to manipulate three or four vials to make a dose, yes, you can get the same dose, but you're in an emergency situation and it's not great. So we do have pharmacists all over in clinical areas, and that is frustrating. I will say that at University of Utah Health, we invest a lot of effort up front so that people are aware when we do have a shortage. We try to provide some lead time so that it's not an immediate emergency.
Is it calling other hospitals? I mean, are pharmacists wheeling and dealing behind the scenes, or is that not how that works?
No, I mean, you can try to do that a little bit, but really nobody is going to have enough stock on hand to really help make a difference.
Right. It's a universal shortage everywhere.
Exactly. For the most part. Exactly. So, you know, sometimes what you can do is if your wholesaler is out, you can try to order it directly from the drug company, and sometimes they will have some and they will ship it to you. Unfortunately, that usually only works for larger health systems because drug companies are usually only set up to send maybe like a pallet instead of maybe 25 vials.
So one of the things that is affecting drug shortages, and we just had a recent story about this in the news, cyber attacks on pharmacies. So what is that kind of – that seems like a kind of a tangential threat to drug shortages as well. What was the university's experience with that, and how are things now?
Yeah, you know, this is a big problem to have kind of a switch that communicates between insurance companies and medical claims. It affected entire health systems, pharmacies especially, because most people are used to paying a copay. And that switch is the thing that tells the pharmacist how much that copay should be. We're back up and running. We were able to switch to a different company. But if you rely on a copay card, some of those haven't been able to switch over.
A little bit of sticker shock for some patients.
A sticker shock, sure. You know, yeah, people aren't used to seeing that their inhaler costs almost $600. The bright side of COVID was, and I think why I'm more optimistic about shortages right now is because of there are more supply chain stories. Like COVID normalized the supply chain story. Before that, I would talk to reporters, but they only really wanted to talk if they could dig up a patient that was harmed, right? Or talk to a doctor who was mad about it. Now, they'll just talk about it in general, and that is such a switch, and I think it is moving the discussion forward. Yeah.
A dumb question, but I get the just-in-time, as-needed manufacturing process. Is it partly because medications lose their efficacy, or is that really not – I mean, can you store these things for a decade or the year?
Most of these injectable products that are in glass vials, they have 2 to 3 year shelf life. But when you're making 30 different drugs on your manufacturing line, some of those are profitable and some are not profitable. And so you're turning them out and then, you know, you make a batch. And if you have to go back and make more of that batch, it's either going to impact another drug. Plus there's cleaning time. So, yeah, there's no incentive to have extra since they don't make any money on it. But, you know, things like Humira, you know, these branded products, there's never been a shortage of those products.
So the University of Utah is known nationally as this place that tracks these drug shortages. You do media, you know, nationally almost every day. How did we get that reputation? Why is the University of Utah known for tracking drug shortages?
So there are two websites that people can go to get drug shortage information. One is FDA, and one is the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. And University of Utah has provided all of the data for that ASHP, American Society of Health System Pharmacists, website since 2001. You know, media hasn't always been my favorite thing to do. I can't say that it's still my favorite thing to do, especially TV. I love a podcast. It's great.
I know. We just get to sit here and look at each
so
other.
Good. And, yep. But, you know, I will say that early on, I saw some stories about drug shortages where the facts were wrong, and I knew they were wrong. And I actually went to our public relations folks and asked, you know, can we ask for a retraction? Can we do something? You know, it's so frustrating that this reporter put this wrong information out there, and people might think that's true. And it was great because our public relations folks, who I love dearly, looked at me and said, you know what, Aaron, we asked you if you wanted to talk to that reporter, and you said no. And it's true, I wasn't comfortable talking to the media. And so what I did was I thought, okay, I really care about getting the right information out there. And so I will invest in learning how to talk to the media, and that's what I've done.
Interesting. How big is the team that you oversee now that does the tracking of the drug shortages?
You know, we have about 4 people that really spend most of their days on drug shortages.
Wow. So you kind of answered this, but I am curious. So you trained to be a pharmacist. How did you come to this job? Like, what was your pathway to pharmacy? And did you always want to be a pharmacist?
No, you know, I always liked science. So I got a biology degree here from the U, graduated. I worked at ARUP in the laboratory. Didn't really like that. Wasn't seeing a path to grad school and PhD in an area that I was super passionate about. A friend of mine was taking some early pharmacy classes, and I went and took one with him, and I really liked it. I really liked how you're helping people, but it's also very science-based. I love how you are always learning. There's always a new drug approved that you have to learn more about, and I really enjoy that.
Where do you go to pharmacy school?
I went here to the U.
University.
Three degrees from the U.
3 degrees?
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, last question, and I'm curious if there's anything consumers can do, but what advice do you have for consumers?
I would say don't panic. It's really easy to get scared, especially if you have cancer or a loved one with cancer and you see news stories about cancer chemotherapy shortages. In most cases, patients are not going without the drug. There's a lot of effort that goes on behind the scenes to try to stretch doses, use alternatives that are just as effective. So don't panic. And then if it's like a pill or a tablet, it's okay to shop around at a different pharmacy. But have that relationship with your pharmacist and ask them, because they might be getting some in the next day. And so if you move your prescription around too much, you kind of might get out of line. But my best advice is don't panic. In most cases, very few patients are actually going without shortages. It's usually just pain and suffering inside the pharmacy system.
Are you hopeful for the future? Are things getting better? Do we have more work to do? What's next?
Last spring, I had the opportunity to testify for a Senate committee. And I will say that this is the most congressional interest that I've seen in over 20 years of tracking national drug shortages. So I'm a little bit hopeful, but at the same time, it's a really hard problem to solve. That rating system that I talked about, FDA is not super in favor of that because they don't want people to think that there are differences between generic products. And so I think until we can get at that rating system, we will still have drug shortages.
Erin, thank you for being my guest on New Rising.
Thanks, Chris.
Listeners, that's it for today's episode. Our executive producer is Brooke Adams, and our technical producer is Robert Nelson. I'm your host, Chris Nelson. Thanks for listening.